Well, several years ago, people started calling this program reporting on a very strange affliction. We call it Morgellons disease. We sent the investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe on the story, and she came back with more information. And as you know, she's still working on some more information as we speak. The CDC states that while it is not known at present whether the condition represents a new disease entity or whether persons who identify themselves as having Morgellons have a common cause for their symptoms, they share common risk factors perhaps, or are contagious, it has begun an investigation of this situation. Let's see how far that goes. In a moment, our special report begins on Morgellons disease on Coast to Coast AM. Now, Dr. Amelia Withington will be with us for the entire program tonight. In this hour, she'll be joined with Randy Wymore, Dr. PhD type. Dr. Amelia is a physician who has and treats Morgellons disease. She's a board certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology and practices in just a variety of outpatient settings. Dr. Withington has treated patients with Morgellons since 2006. Amelia is currently working on a book about her experiences with Morgellon. Here she is on Coast to Coast. Hello, doctor. How are you?
Hi. Fine, thanks. Thanks so much for having me on the program.
Oh, me too. I am glad we're going to get some information out about this affliction. And we've got Randy Wymore with us as well, completed his studies in physiology and biophysics in 1995. Dr. Wymore has co-authored 17 articles published in peer-reviewed scientific journals, and that's a lot. Randy spends the bulk of his time working on Morgellons disease and is director of the OSU CHS Center for the Investigation of Morgellons Disease. He's with us this hour. Hey, Randy, how are you?
I'm doing fine, George. How are you?
Good. Thanks for coming aboard here. Let's talk with you for just a moment, Amelia, about Morgellons, a situation that people are beginning to come public with, though not a lot of doctors understand it or even know how to treat it. How did you get involved in it? How did you first learn about Morgellons disease?
I first learned about it at the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society conference in San Francisco this past October. I had recently been diagnosed with Lyme disease myself after having had symptoms for about 30 years. And Cindy Casey, a nurse with Morgellons who was on the Discovery Channel Mystery ER program about Morgellons, had a booth set up. I had never even heard of the condition, although with her excellent information and some diagnostic equipment she had, it was clear that's what I had. And I realized that I actually had been treating patients with it, not even realizing that it was an entity.
And Randy, how about you?
Well, for me, it was just a complete accident of searching the internet. I was looking for some information on muscle fibers, and one of the hits came back as the fiber disease. I thought, what's that? Clicked on it, took me to some information about Morgellons disease, and that began the fascination and curiosity, and I've just continued to work more on it, and starting out from part-time to full-time in research.
All right. Dr. Withington, how many people do you think in North America might have this and they don't even know what they have?
That is a really difficult question. I think there are actually quite a few people undiagnosed with Lyme disease because the tests are so unreliable. A number of patients have been diagnosed with delusional parasitosis and different unexplained dermatomyopathies. But then I think when a detailed history is really taken, especially if they have a sense of something unusual being discharged from their skin, it could be a real lead to identifying Morgellons.
Let's talk, if we can, Amelia and Randy, jump in as well. There are fibers associated with this disease. What the heck are these things?
Great question. Randy, do you want to start?
Well, that's sort of the main focus of what we've been trying to do, and in fact have received a very generous donation recently that is targeted directly at doing some testing to try and figure out what the fibers are. Originally, the fiber analysis was just to try and demonstrate that they weren't simply textiles, cotton, nylon, rayon, that sort of thing.
Right.
And that was the easy part. With the help of the Tulsa Police Department Forensics Laboratory, we were able to demonstrate that these are not no known textiles, but they were not able to identify what the fibers were made of. And it's been my hope for a couple of years now that if we can ever get a good handle on what these actually are, it could help guide us in the direction of where to look for the causative agent and ultimately a treatment.
Are they organic or are they created, man-made?
Well, organic in the chemistry sense, that's not relevant because all of the organic compounds just means it has carbon and hydrogen. So we don't know whether they're synthetic in the sense of made by a human, made by a microorganism, made by the patient themselves. They are organic from a chemical perspective.
If you pull one out, Randy, and look under a microscope, what does it look like? A hair?
Well, it typically is smaller than a hair, more like in length. It would be more like, say, an eyebrow from a very, very young child.
Okay.
And similar in diameter.
All right, but what's the makeup under a microscope?
Oh, they're very nondescript. That's part of the problem. They don't have any of the synthesizing marks like you would find, say, from synthetic fiber like nylon, rayon, polyester, that sort of thing. They don't have shear marks where they were cut at one end or another. They're often pointed at both ends, which is clearly not something you would find with any known textiles.
There's
not a lot to see in them.
This may sound bizarre, but are they alive?
Well, not as far as we can tell in any conventional sense. There are no cells associated with them. There's no cell nucleus. They don't seem to be some sort of a worm. They don't have a cuticle, which is typically the outer coating you would find. As far as the tinier worms, you can often look through them and see the cell arrangement, the nuclei. None of that's present in these.
So they're not multiplying, I guess, right?
No. I mean, the individual fibers. Yeah, we've tried that experiment too. They do not multiply or move within their container.
All right, Amelia. Generally, a person afflicted with Morgellons, as you call it, how many of these fibers are sticking out of their body? Are they all over the place?
It's a really interesting question. What is my personal experience, and that of my patients, is that, for lack of a better word, they seem to come and go in crops. They're very small, and I choose the word crops for a specific reason. This phenomenon was first described in the 1600s by an English physician visiting some ill children in France. He noticed a phenomenon where, as their fevers broke and they seemed to be starting to get better, strange hairs emerged from their backs and fell off. And that was the first clue that someone had this century looking back in the medical literature. Dr. Stricker has done some research. He used to be the head of the International Lyme Associated Diseases Society and now practices in San Francisco, that it appears that in some cases, and I'm saying some cases because I think this is a very complex condition, there is probably DNA exchange between a plant and a better known bacteria like Lyme disease, where whatever this hybrid is seems to try to produce a plant-like fiber. Randy, tell me if I'm on track that some of the fibers under the microscope perhaps resemble cellulose, and maybe this is an attempt by whatever this hybrid is to produce something. The body's immune system recognizes that it's foreign and literally kicks it out through the skin. That's what I think might be happening.
You know, both of you know, with this program, we cover everything. I mean, everything. And is it conceivable that whatever folks have, they are breathing this from the atmosphere somehow?
I tend to doubt it. I thought your previous segment with Marla James was excellent as well on the necrotizing fasciitis.
Yes.
My sense is that unless someone is susceptible for some reason, you know, exposed to a virus or maybe already immunocompromised, they're unlikely to contract it just by casual contact. In the case of Morgellons, there's almost always been a contact with soil. And that was true in my case and in my patients as well. Either gardening, hiking, one person bumped into a tree and had an outbreak a week later. So there's almost always perhaps an inoculation of some sort in someone who's susceptible.
So I wanted to rule out the possibility that, you know, there's some kind of terrorist act out there, or this is being sprayed on people from above. I guess, can we rule that out?
Well, the distribution doesn't suggest any sort of a terrorist act. We have Oklahoma State University has a web-based registration page for people with Morgellons who wish to register to get information in the future or potentially participate in research. And, you know, while there are more people registering from a bit more from California, Texas, Florida, you know, all 50 states, Canada, Mexico, numerous foreign countries. Yeah, there's just not the, usually with you know, what you would be sort of thinking of in terms of the terrorist activity, you would have a distinct, discrete hot zone that it spread from.
Yeah, there'd be a pattern.
And there is absolutely no pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Several callers I have had to this program over the last few months claim that they have this, claim that they may have gotten it after being bitten by a bird or pecked by a bird. Is that conceivable?
I certainly think so. And I think we may be seeing transmission through a vector like some of the tick-borne illnesses where these bacteria can survive in the gut of an insect. Birds have mites. You know, other kinds of woodland creatures have them. And if a person is directly bitten by an insect that has these bacteria in its saliva or in the bloodstream, that could be introduced into a person's bloodstream.
Some of the people have said, this is years ago now, that they feel as if things are crawling under their skin.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an accurate assessment?
That's how it feels, extremely itchy.
Oh, gosh.
Definitely. And there could be an association in some cases with parasites perhaps carrying the bacteria initially. In my particular case, and those of my patients in this region of the country, it doesn't seem to be an ongoing identifiable parasitic infestation, and it doesn't respond to antiparasitic medications in the way we're used to thinking about conditions like scabies and so forth. And yet early on, people sometimes do have that sensation or even find insects. In other parts of the country, I've heard of people actually producing insect parts from their skin. So it's a difficult question.
That's bizarre. Why do some people get it, some people don't?
It's hard to say. I think some people are immunocompromised. When the NIH actually recognized this by name just this past January, they did call it a Lyme disease-associated condition. So far, of the Morgellons patients identified, about 95% eventually test positive for Lyme disease. So it's probably an immunocompromised situation.
That's interesting. Randy, let's go back to the fibers for just a second. What colors are they?
Well, the most common ones are actually sort of translucent to almost a cream-colored. The more vivid ones, though, that tend to catch a lot of the media attention tend to be sort of a cobalt blue or almost magenta-red color.
Yeah. Would one be able to easily distinguish these fibers from hairs looking at them on their body?
Well, hairs definitely are not the thing they most closely resemble. So that wouldn't be a problem at all.
So these would stand out then?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing that they would look most like to a casual look would be some sort of a textile fiber.
And scientists are baffled with this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm baffled. my research associate and my lab tech has been working on this for almost 3 years now. She's pretty baffled.
Are you afraid, Randy, to touch these fibers with your fingers?
Well, not more so than anything else we would be doing in the lab. So, I mean, in the lab, samples are handled wearing gloves. But then we would do that with just because of the bacteria that we would have in the lab anyway. Now, we don't take more precautions with Morgellons samples than we do with any of the lab samples we use.
Some people have been told that they have psychiatric problems, that this isn't real, that it's in their mind. Amelia, you first.
It's absolutely real. And when I spoke at the Morgellons conference last week, I have never met a person with true delusions of parasitosis. There's always a reason. And so often these diagnoses are being given by people who aren't psychiatrists, other medical professions who can't find an explanation for it. If I had a patient with something that looked like a melanoma, I wouldn't say, that's a melanoma, I'm going to recommend you get surgery right away. I'd say, I'm concerned about how that looks. Let me refer you to an expert.
I would guess if any of these victims might have some emotional problems, it's because mainstream medicine isn't helping them.
That can certainly be true. As with many chronic illnesses, there can be depression and anxiety associated. But in addition is the complexity that there seems to be a pretty persistent pattern with people with Morgellons disease of having difficulty with insomnia, of not thinking as clearly, you know, perceiving brain fog or cognitive problems. And many of those things look like symptoms of depression or other psychiatric conditions.
Give us symptoms.
Well, it definitely compounds itself, but certainly I think probably the most telling thing to differentiate Morgellons from any other condition is something unusual being produced from the skin. There may be some people who haven't had something produced from the skin yet, but almost always, even just under the skin, fibers that fluoresce using a Wood's lamp or common dermatologic illumination will be seen under the skin in a sort of a network pattern. So that's almost always identifiable. But then, you know, taking another step further, some of the chronic and difficult to treat and recalcitrant tick-borne illnesses or insect-borne illnesses and the myriad symptoms that go with that can be seen here as well. Extreme fatigue. Some people have wondered, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia.
Yeah.
Some of those cases, undiagnosed chronic illnesses, and you know, some of the symptoms of depression and anxiety that we discussed, undulating fevers. It's a very long list that could be associated.
Very difficult to treat something if you don't know what it is, right?
For sure. Absolutely.
Well, if I could add one thing about the
sure,
your question there. Look, the reality is it doesn't matter what your mood is or what sort of a behavioral condition you might have, you can't manufacture things in your skin just based on a desire to have something there.
Exactly.
And I'm a scientist, a PhD, but at medical school where I work, physicians have done the clinical side of looking into this, and between the three physicians who have worked on this, they've seen over 30 patients, and uniformly, those that have Morgellons disease have things within their skin.
Mm-hmm.
They're fairly superficial in the sense that they don't seem to be buried deeply down into the subcutaneous tissue, but that's never observed in a what I'll call a negative control person.
Exactly.
Someone like me who rolls up their sleeve or has their back examined looking to see what the skin looks like in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big difference. And you just can't imagine that stuff into your skin.
No, that's a huge difference. By the way, let's get a website out for people who want to go to it. What do you recommend, Amelia?
www.thenmo.org. It looks like Venmo, just all one word, no spaces. It stands for the New Morgellons Order. It's the website administrated by Cindy Casey. And there are regular contributions from Ginger Savely, Dr. Raphael Stricker, Dr. Wymore, myself. It's people who are really working with this on the day-to-day.
Good for both of you. We'll be back with both of you in just a moment at Coast to Coast AM. Well, you can get up to the brand new coasttocoastam.com website. You can also sign up for StreamLink if you're not a member, where you get podcasts and downloads. And they are now working feverishly on pushing the 90-day downloads way back. Not done yet. They're working on it, but it's going to happen. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Amelia Withington and Randy Wymore. Randy, are we getting any evidence, you know, Amelia was talking about parasites earlier, of bugs under the skin? Are we seeing anything like that?
Well, our physicians have not, and we haven't amplified any DNA using a technique called PCR where we try specifically to amplify the DNA of certain organisms. My idea had just been, because a number of people had commented about that, was that if some bug had been present, and by bug, I'm using that in a very loose term here.
Right. We don't mean insect.
Not that, well, but including insects, yes, we've actually looked for
but
some.
It could be.
All the way down to really tiny, almost microscopic, again, for lack of a better term, bugs, but then also specific bacteria, fungal forms. We've tried to amplify DNA of all sorts of organisms and have been unsuccessful at finding anything that's which overtly pathogenic. They typically are just things you would find on skin or the environment, which is very frustrating.
What's it going to take, Randy, to bust this through to get some real information and knowledge that we know what it is and we know how to fight it? What's it going to take?
Well, it's either going to take getting incredibly lucky, and that's what we've been sort of hoping for with just myself and my lab technician working on this. Otherwise, it's going to take, much like, you know, other diseases and conditions, it's going to take systematically working through the possibilities, multiple people, multiple researchers working on it. Ultimately, sadly, it's going to take more money than is easy to get a hold of to do this. Last year, the Department of Defense had an interesting set of grant proposals on Gulf War illness. Ooh. And Gulf War illness symptoms are actually very, very similar to Morgellons, minus the fibers.
Minus the fibers.
And that's not just because necessarily they've looked and not seen them, but my question was, has anyone really looked? So I wrote a small pilot study proposal just to look through the local VA and compare, get our physicians to look at the skin of Gulf War illness victims to see if by some chance they have under the skin the fibers. But alas, they decided that grant wasn't worthy of funding.
Amelia, is this happening in other countries?
Definitely. I was just looking tonight online at a map that shows different countries. It's clearly been identified in North America, Australia, New Zealand, 8 countries in Europe, and then around the Pacific basin, Indonesia and some of those countries. There don't appear to be any reports as yet from South America or Central Asia, China. But that could be an issue of reporting. It may not be that it doesn't exist there. But even going online, there's a lot of discussion in Australia and so forth. So there are some pretty active communities in other countries.
I can add to that also.
Sure.
Our database where people register is, of course, HIPAA-protected, and we haven't published any. I don't have an epidemiologist to do a real formal study, but in South America, at the Oklahoma State University website, we've had people register from Brazil, Ecuador, Peru, Argentina. So South America is represented. You know, it's clearly slanted as far as our registrations go toward people who either speak or can read English.
Right.
Or, you know, can muddle through enough to be able to fill out an online form and send it in. Every European country, some in South America, and, yeah, across the Pacific, and even in the Middle East, we have had a few registrations from Israel, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, in Africa.
Are these bacteria, or is it a virus?
Well, from my perspective, I have no clue yet, because we haven't, you know, I'm purely working at this from the perspective of try and identify what the causative organism or environmental factor might be. We haven't found that yet. So at this point, you know, virtually anything's up for grabs. Now, personally, I'm hoping it's not a virus, just because that's going to be the hardest of all to identify.
And fight, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, probably fight, but even just getting to the point of identification. See, at least with bacteria, they all share some things in common. And so we don't have to try and isolate totally unique bacteria, I mean, just completely hunting for some new sequence. They share certain genes with each other, and even with us, for that matter, that we can use as sort of the bait to try and find that using PCR. Viruses, on the other hand, that's not the case. They're all different.
Explain the difference, Randy, between bacteria and a virus.
Well, a virus is just basically a tiny packet of DNA or RNA, so the genetic information, and then in its most simplest form, it's encapsulated with something. It might be protein. It might have something to do with a bacterial membrane. It might be a cell membrane from an animal or a bird or an organism, that whatever its host happens to be. It doesn't live on its own separately as a freestanding entity. That's why, you know, one time there's a big debate, well, are viruses alive? Are they not alive? Well, that's kind of irrelevant, really. They interact with living things. They are able to reproduce. But what they do then is typically take over the machinery of the cell that they've invaded to make more of them.
All right. What would happen to a virus if you, let's say, took it away from its host, from wherever it may be, and just isolated it and put it, for example, in a little Petri dish all by itself? Would it dry up? Would it die? What would happen to it?
That's, again, quite variable from virus to virus. So many viruses are very sensitive. So a few hours to a few days outside of their host, they're a goner. Their membranes have broken down, or their DNA. You know, and so a lot of these, if they're just hit by sunlight, that's enough to kill them.
That's it.
Now, on the other hand, some are quite hardy and can go months in the environment and still be viable.
We have to learn how to flush them out of people's bodies somehow, you know?
And there are undoubtedly a lot of them.
Yep. Okay. So there's that. Then now what about the bacteria?
Well, bacteria are much like us. They are individual cells. We are made up of individual cells that come together to form an organism. Bacteria typically are freestanding. They don't have to aggregate to form, you know, a multicellular complex organism. But at the genetic level, they share many of the same genes that we do. Before getting involved in Morgellons research, I did cardiac research, and one of the potassium channel genes that is in all of our hearts is very similar to a gene that one finds in plants and even in bacteria. One can line up the sequences, and it's truly amazing. So they are truly alive in more in the sense that we would recognize. They have to eat. They have to take in oxygen or some other oxidizing agent that they can use for their processes. They typically use glucose or something related to that for fuel, much as we do. They have to get rid of waste products, and then they go through cell division where one cell will divide into two daughter cells. So it's more typical life as we would recognize it.
Are you baffled by this disease?
Oh, quite so.
Yeah.
I mean, my wife also is a registered nurse and has a master's in physiology and biophysics. And, you know, there's definitely not a week ever in the last 4 years has gone by that we don't discuss it at home.
And does it appear to be growing, the affliction?
Well, I mean, there are a constant stream. You know, so for me, it's partly based on what I see through our web-based registration site. And
That's growing.
Yeah, oh, yeah. There's rarely a day that, you know, several people don't register. But in terms of how it has changed over the last couple of years, it's not growing faster. So, you know, if we're running sort of, 3 to 15 registrations per day. It's been doing that pretty consistently throughout this time period. Now, whenever there's a media piece on Morgellons, it will spike. You know, but
well,
that's
then expect the spike then.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
Like
tomorrow, I'm actually. Let's see. I've got my email running. So actually, we've had three people registered while your show's been on.
Now, let's hope we can help.
And I bet that that's from, you know, the odds are, being in the middle of the night, that that might be from someone listening. So, you know, over the last couple of years, we have around 13,000. I don't know the exact number because there are a few duplicates where people will hit send multiple times, that sort of thing.
Is it seasonal?
No.
It's not.
No, I mean, it doesn't seem to be as far as the registrations coming in. But the lag time between when a person, and see, I don't even know what word to use since we don't know what causes it are affected, infected. But what, from whenever, whatever that first contact is to when the symptoms manifest or they figure out it's more, it might be more Guillain's, are we talking weeks, months, years? I can't give a good answer to that, so I really don't know.
Can your pet get this? And if so, how do you know it has it?
Well, this is purely anecdotal, of course, because I haven't, you know, I'm not a veterinarian or a veterinary researcher, but I have heard that, I'll put it this way, I have spoken to a couple of veterinarians who have seen animals who they observed seem to have similar symptoms to whatever their owners have.
So they might get it from the owner. It's possible.
Or vice versa.
Or the other way around.
Or they just happen to both be in the same environmental set of circumstances.
Where they got
at the same
it.
Time. Right.
Yeah. I got to tell you, though, between flesh-eating bacteria and this, I'm going to live in a glass jar.
You'd pretty much have to. I mean, some of that, the necrotizing fasciitis, I mean, this. I don't know. I didn't get to hear the first part of your show. My internet was down.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a bike rider crossing the country and got a little bite or nick or something in the middle of the desert in eastern Nevada. I mean, that's not a real hospitable environment for life in general. And it's not the sort of place you'd necessarily be worried about bacteria. And they had to be airlifted from, I think, Winnemucca, Nevada to Reno and ultimately to Sacramento to the UC Davis Medical Center where they almost lost their leg.
Jeez. Wow. All right, Amelia, let's speculate for a moment here, and we'll label it as that, pure speculation. How do you think people are coming down with this?
I think it does tend to happen to people who are already susceptible. I think what Myla James had to say was so important. You still have to live your life. If you like hugging your family, hug your family. You're probably not going to give it to them unless they're already compromised, too, for some reason. But again, you know, just being aware that there can be risks, practicing good hygiene, protecting yourself against insect bites. If you love gardening, you know, try to really cover yourself with gloves and wash off after you've been gardening because there are, you know, plant oils and that kind of thing that could aggravate. But it just seems to me like pathogens may be combining in a new way. I mean, even I looked at the website Marla James has while we were on, and they had some really interesting research where with streptococcal bacteria, in some cases, a virus has combined with what was originally a fairly mundane bacteria, essentially jump-started it, and it becomes very virulent. Could something like that be going on here, where a virus and a bacteria got together? Maybe in some cases fungus, plant material. We're not sure. But I don't think it's aerosolized, and I really doubt that it's easily transmissible from person to person. I think if you're susceptible, you just have to be extra careful.
Yeah, I would agree about the it is either not contagious in a typical sense, or it's not very contagious.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, just based on the registrations and the many, many people I've had emails and phone conversations with and met in person, where you have, you know, significant others, husbands, wives, gay couples, who one has it, the other one does not. They've been living in close proximity for years. Then there's the flip side. There are whole families that seem to have it. So I can't say that it's not contagious, but it's not highly contagious because, quite frankly, if there were thousands of people, let's just pretend that for a second, or maybe tens of thousands of people across just the United States with something that was highly contagious like Morgellons, we'd all have it.
But maybe we don't know, Randy. Maybe because it's so strange, there could be thousands and thousands of people walking around with it and they don't know it.
Well, I'm sure there are a number of people who, you know, who have just been diagnosed with dermatitis or eczema, maybe, that have this. But, you know, you can't focus too much just on the skin symptoms. They're the most in-your-face symptom, and they're what the media likes because of the red and blue fibers. But the reality is this is a systemic disorder that affects multiple systems, and including often behavioral changes, cognitive changes, difficulty in focusing thoughts. And, you know, when you start adding up all of those symptoms, it's sort of like, you know, there's some things you don't wonder if you have it. You would just know if you'd ever heard about it.
What do you think?
Heard about it. That's
true.
The key thing.
What do you think the breakthrough, Randy, is going to be?
Well, either identifying an organism, if there is an organism involved, if there's some common environmental factor that really is common to all these people that we just have, it's not obvious, that would be good. Or I'm still, you know, holding on to the idea that if we can figure out what some of the shed material from the skin, and it's not just fibers, there are black specks and sort of sand-like looking granules, small ones, that so far we've not been able, using mass spec and other chemical analysis means we've not figured out what they're made of. I still do hope that if we can figure out for sure what the identity of this material is, it will guide the direction of the research into where it might be coming from.
Does this get in people's lungs at all, the fibers?
There are people who claim to cough up material from their lungs where there are fibers embedded. Now, that's not something that has helped us out research-wise, just because, you know, if a person coughs up a fur ball and sends it to us, it's not... We don't have chain of custody typically to be able to keep it clean, to not have fungal material growing in it. But it's definitely a possibility.
I think what might be more likely, though, is that this seems to live in a dermal layer. And as you know, that coats both the inside and the outside of the body.
Right.
So I believe it could line the throat and so forth, but it doesn't seem to collect in the lungs like asbestosis or a tuberculosis nodule, or even the cysts that might be associated with Lyme disease and some of its co-infections. Fortunately, the skin manifestations seem to be on the surface, whether it's interior or exterior.
Could this be caused by lotions and soap and stuff like that? Clothes from China?
Probably.
Who knows?
Yeah. My thought is probably not. How about you, Randy?
Well, I mean, there's nothing obvious in what people have claimed about product usage. You know, that's where a really good epidemiology study could include looking at certain things like
absolutely,
like products that have been used and so forth. But just sort of a non-scientific, off-the-cuff, asking some questions of people, there don't seem to be any commonalities. I mean, we have everything from really just hardcore vegans who don't touch anything that's not organic, you know, as far as synthetic soaps and materials.
And they're getting this, yeah.
Yeah, they have this. Because the diet had come up at one time as well, could it have something to do with meat? Ovo-lacto-vegetarians, hardcore meat eaters, you know. I mean, it just really does run the gamut. And that's part of the irritation about trying to figure out what this is. There don't seem to be climate issues. You know, everything from cold to very dry to warm and moist, coastal, landlocked, all those sorts of usual things you look at for viruses and certain bacteria and even parasites don't seem to fit any of the typical patterns here. And product usage is not one of those things.
All right. Randy, thank you for spending the hour with us. Dr. Emilio Withington, we're going to be back with you in just a moment with Tricia Springstead on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Emilio Withington is staying with us, and she'll be joined with registered nurse Tricia Springstead. Both of them are next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, this hour we're joined with Tricia Springstead, registered RN treating Morgellons patients. Tricia trained in medicine at Loma Linda University and Riverside State College, UCSB as well. Tricia currently working on her doctorate in holistic and alternative medicine, and here she is on Coast to Coast. Hi, Tricia, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I'm glad to know that you are working on alternative medicine and holistic. I think that's very important.
I am. I need to tell you something, though, first. We can't say as a nurse that I'm treating patients. What I'm doing right now is I'm like an air traffic controller for Morgellons. What I'm doing is I'm getting these people doctors that will see them.
Well, say you assist patients.
Absolutely, I do. I counsel them on the phone. I've seen probably now 140 sufferers. Myself, and I'm working with Dr. Cheryl Reed here in Florida. Dr. Susan Kolb has been really amazing with these patients. Another thing I want to say is I really want to thank Randy Wymore, because Randy saved a lot of lives. If he would not have stepped out and said that this was real, I have no idea how many people would have died from this.
Yeah.
I've had... You know, and Dr. Whittington, you are absolutely awesome. You've got a good heart. Your patients love you. And I really have to tell you that I have to also really thank Hildegard Staninger. I think everybody in this has a piece of a patchwork. And I wrote this. We all have a piece of a quilt. And my goal and what I would like to see happen is I would like to see all the doctors involved in this, Dr. James Matthews, Dr. Hildegard Staninger, Dr. Susan Kolb, Dr. Whittington, Ahmed Kalani is awesome. I'm also working with many alternative and complementary doctors here in I'm in California right now, which is really awesome.
Yeah.
But I think that if we could get all these people into one room, there's also a wonderful advocate, and his name is Niels Meyer. And I have just the utmost respect for him and what he's trying to do.
How did you get involved in all this, Tricia?
I think my life was about this, but it was very serendipitous. I invented a patent 15 years ago. Long story short, my mother had lung cancer, and we watched my father die from cancer. And so we started reading the book by Hulda Clark on cancer. And my mother refused to take chemotherapy, and she also refused to do radiation. And so we met Hulda Clark in Mexico. At the time, she had been excommunicated from the country for practicing medicine without a license. And she was in Mexico, so I took my mother to her, and then we started looking at skincare. We started looking at the propyls and the methyls and the hexyls and the garbage, the filtration systems that they put oils through. So I started doing research on organics and botanicals, and I came up with a patent, and really it was in honor of my mother. Then we started seeing what it was doing with psoriasis. We would put it on psoriatic patients, and it's a three-step system, and it would draw the dormant psoriasis out from the skin. And then they would get worse, but then they would get better. They would get redder, but then they would get better from it. And then we would work on their diet and things like that. Well, there was an article in the St. Pete Times, and that was over three years ago, an article in the St. Pete Times about my patent and its effects on psoriasis. And a friend of mine had written her doctoral thesis on the use of my patent on psoriatic patients. We presented that before the dermatology people at USF, and they said, we're not doing a study on botanicals because that's crazy. So I did get the patent status, and then in 2006 is really when it all started happening. People started walking into my shop, and I had an office there, and they had the funkiest looking rashes. I mean, they were unbelievable. But then, in particular, there was a young woman that worked for CNN. Her name was Susan. And Susan walked in the door. I got a phone call from somebody that worked with her, who's a dear friend of mine, Nancy Toller.
Okay.
And Susan walked in the door, and she was cowering in the corner. And she had lesions. I have never seen anybody so sick in my life.
Were they all over her?
All over her body. She looked like she had been treated so badly by her peers and where she worked. And so she came to me, and I said, not knowing that it was deep, more than skin deep, I said, maybe I can help you, Susan. And so I took her into the I had a shower and a bathroom in my office, and I took her in, and we put the soap on her skin, and all of a sudden it was like her skin was bubbling. And I had a glass plate there. I'm a scientist, you know. Here I am, I have a glass plate. And I started extracting parasites from her. These strange looking parasites. I didn't know I was supposed to be looking for fibers. And then I did it. Then what happened was I kept seeing more and more and more people coming in with this. So I finally, my husband thought I was nuts, and I finally said, you know, I need to do an observation, because I didn't have time to file for an internal research grant or anything like that. So my husband said, all right, prove it to me, Trish. Take my office. So what we did was we had 10 people that came from all over the country. I had an entomologist there. I had two of my peers there, doctors that I had worked with in clinical settings. And then I had two nurse practitioners there. Nancy Toller was there, and myself, and 10 patients. So what happened was, here again, I thought, wow, maybe I have the cure for this. This is just a skin disease. So what I did was we soaked all these people down with this soap. And then what it does is it relaxes the pores, because it has German chamomile in it.
Okay.
And I extracted, you've seen some of the photos I've sent you?
Yes.
The black fly?
Yes.
Now we're getting fibers, we're getting black fly, we're getting midges. I'm working with Stacy Strickland, who is he is awesome in Hernando County. And he really didn't want to get involved in this, but, you know, I kind of...
You pulled him in.
I did. And so I took a bunch of my slides to him, and we started looking at slides. And he spent a whole day with me going over and over and over slides. Well, he used to be an MD pathologist, and he got bored, so he went and got an entomology, PhD in entomology, and he's a soil entomologist. So we started pulling out fungal hyphae. We started seeing Alternarium, Calendula. Deb Alschuler, way back, I really can't remember the year, but she did a study in Oklahoma. And Sydney Presley, who has been a mother to me through this, and who has been a sufferer for years, has really, really shared information with me and worked with me. And she's really an awesome woman. Anyways, Deborah Oschler years ago did a Calendula study in Oklahoma, and she went to the CDC, and she warned them that something is coming down, and it's coming down big.
Typical CDC, though. They probably didn't listen.
Well, you know what? I can't dislike the CDC. I mean, you know, there's some really good people there.
Oh, well, that's probably true.
Yeah, I just think they're a little slow on the uptake. You know, that's just my personal opinion. But, you know, I think that what's going on here is the other thing that we need to understand, too, is these people are magnetic. I do the weirdest. These patients, You know, they're so interesting, and I love spending time talking to them and sitting with them. I mean, I was in Atlanta, and I saw a few patients that were up there, and we were in my hotel room, and one particular patient, her name is Kelly, and she's so funny. She's really cute. She's in Atlanta. She pulls two hairs out of her head, and she puts them between her fingers, and I'm looking, and those hairs are sticking straight up and dancing. And you're talking 4-inch hairs, like interacting with each other. And so I pulled two hairs out of my head, and I said, mine aren't doing that. This is really weird. And Nancy was with me, and she goes, mine aren't doing that. But these more the people that had Morgellons, their hair was dancing, like they had electrostatic shock. And then they talk about how they are always being hit by something. You know?
What do you mean by that?
Well, they feel biting. They feel, in their environment, they feel biting. Also, the other really interesting thing, and we have a support group in Florida, and I'm working with some awesome scientists out here in California, too. But we have a support group in Florida at Dr. Cheryl Reed's office, and she does that the last Friday of every month. And she will not turn my patients away. She's unbelievable. They all say the same thing. I ask them these questions like, I've heard from every one of these people. They've said to me, I'll ask a question. I'll say, okay, now I've listened to so many of you. I'm going to start asking you some questions. Do you see floaters behind your eyes? Yes. Are you hearing strange sounds like, you know, when you're in a shower, and they say, yeah, like a whirring sound.
Huh.
So this is very sensory. Is your taste different? Yes. Is your sense of smell different? Yes. And then I'll ask them about brain fog. And then I ask them to go way back, if they can remember it, go way, way, way back. And when you first started, because they're so brain fogged, many of them can't remember. But many of them can say, I remember a time when I had a bite, and within 24 hours, there was another thing on the opposite side of the body in the exact same place. So that shows me that there's a lot of neurological something going on here.
Yeah. Now, what is your best guess how these people are getting this, Tricia?
I believe, all right, let me just go over some differential diagnoses that doctors are giving these people.
Okay.
Neurodermatitis. Neurocutaneous syndrome.
Explain what that is to we non-medical folks.
Neurodermatitis is a skin. Derma means skin. Neuro means nerve. And itis means inflammation of. Okay?
Okay.
So it's an inflammation of the neuron endings under the skin. There are also acne, eczema, psoriasis with biting, chronic fatigue, Gulf War syndrome. Many of these people coming back from Gulf War, I'm in contact with Marcia Haskell Clark, who is really, she called me and said, some of these guys over that are coming back from Afghanistan, that are coming back from Iraq, have this.
Do you know Joyce Riley by any chance?
Yes. Actually, I don't know her personally.
Got to get you in touch with her.
Yeah, but I know that these people have chronic fatigue, multiple chemical sensitivity syndrome, fibromyalgia. Then they diagnose them with scabies, Norwegian scabies. And then I've had doctors say MRSA from across the room. And not show me any kind of clinical swab, no clinical criteria. If you're going to diagnose somebody with MRSA or VRE, then show me a clinical swab.
Yeah.
That it grows MRSA. Leishmaniasis is another one that they're calling Mexican. Somebody said Afghan leishmaniasis, Mexican leishmaniasis, bird mites. Chronic and end-stage Lyme disease. Agrobacterium tumefaciens is what Vitaly Saitovsky saw in like crown gall disease.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've seen slides of Fusarium oxysporum. Now that's a pathogenic fungi. And you know what they do that? You know what they do that with that?
What?
They spray it on drug crops all over the world. On cocaine crops.
Right. I'm beginning to think, and you haven't even said it yet, that you may think this is environmental.
It is.
Yeah.
I'm starting to get to doctors, and they're starting to do heavy metal testing. We are getting positives on toluene. We're getting positives on mercury. We're getting positives on barium. We're getting positives on manganite. We're getting positives on all kinds of heavy metals.
All right. If it's environmental, Tricia,
yes, sir.
How are they contracting it? Are they drinking it? Are they touching it? Is it being sprayed on us?
Well, you know, we can talk about chemtrails till the cows come home. We can talk about alien invasions, but guess what? Our planet is horribly, horribly in a mess. I believe, you know, when the last hurricane came through in Louisiana,
yeah,
the reports and the people and the phone calls went up exponentially. Now, what was in that ground? What was that rain carrying?
Good point.
I also have over 46 people that worked at Aberdeen Proving Grounds that have this, and their families. What was in that soil?
46?
46.
Astronomically high compared to other regions?
Absolutely. I'm telling you, this is, you know, I go to the grocery store and I can see this stuff. You know, I was talking to Dr. Kalani.
You mean on people, not food?
Yeah, people.
Oh, okay.
You know, I go to the grocery store and I'm like real hyper vigilant. But, you know, what are you going to do? Walk up to somebody and go, hey, lady, you got more gallons, you know?
Well, knowing you, you might.
I might. You never know, you know. But, you know, I got to tell you, I'm getting phone calls from prisons. I'm getting phone calls from mental hospitals. I'm getting phone calls, and people's lives are falling apart.
Is it growing?
Yes. Exponentially.
Not epidemic stage.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have to say it is.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you differ from Amelia and Randy.
I have to say it is.
Well, it could be epidemic stage because we may see regional variations.
Correct.
Like you see a lot more parasitic involvement.
Correct.
And yet I think there are a lot of people undiagnosed out there.
Right.
In October, I wasn't aware anybody else on the entire planet had experienced what I'd experienced, and I'd learned to keep quiet about it.
And yeah. You know what, Amelia? And I got to say, you are one awesome lady. You are gutsy.
Oh, I'm not worthy.
And since the Barbara Minton articles came out, people have been emailing and calling me from everywhere. I mean, I've even had people checking in from China. I don't read Chinese, so, you know, I'm put that in another folder. But the phone calls have been amazing in Florida, and I've been forwarding a lot of that over to my my congresswoman, because it's really out of control because they're being misdiagnosed.
Exactly.
Now,
and that's the sad part. Tricia, we're going to take this break. Your website, of course, is thenmo.org as well. It's the same with Amelia and Randy's, thenmo.org. Linked up right now to the brand-new coasttocoastam.com website. Back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll keep Dr. Amelia with us. We'll take your phone calls. But when we come back, we'll still be chatting with Tris Springstead about Morgellons on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We've got Dr. Amelia Withington with us and Tricia Springstead as well. Tricia, as you began to notice more and more people coming down with these afflictions, I mean, did you find them to be just out of control, panicking?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I cannot tell you how many divorces I've seen.
Oh.
I cannot tell you how many children have this. Mothers that call me, you know, and basically what we're trying to do is we're trying to do some damage control here. We're trying to get the, well, it's splitting up families. These people are broke. They've been to doctor after doctor after doctor that called them delusional. And I've been telling them, you know, unless they're going to go to somebody like Dr. Whittington, you know, don't waste your money going to the doctor, because then they're just going to tell you you're crazy. And after a while, you do get crazy. If you had this stuff under your skin, you'd be crazy.
Absolutely.
I don't have this. I've touched these people. I've been around these people. I've done full, I mean, I go into these people's homes and evaluate their homes and look and see what's going on there. And it's really amazing. It's really amazing to see even the chemicals that are that we're using in our home are very dangerous. And then people, you know, these doctors say, well, you know, this is scabies. So let's put them on, you know, permethanes, and let's put them in Quell and Lindane. And, you know, that stuff is dangerous. And all it does from my just, you know, my clinical observations are that this stuff is just pushing this stuff, driving it deeper into the body. But the other really interesting thing is that actually I'm working with some very, very brilliant scientists out here in California. And also there's a guy named, a gentleman named Ron Kassan, who's a PhD in physics. Why physics? This is the thing that really blew my mind. I was introduced to Dr. Kassan, and he is just the most wonderful human being. And I started talking to him about possible toluene toxicity. We were talking about the fibers. And I was telling him, you know, these people are heavy metal toxic. They're ticking time bombs. And I said to him, you know, could the fibers be a good thing? And we started talking about them. And if they're made of heavy metals, if they're made of toluene, then maybe that is the beauty of the human body. Now, I'm just, you know, speculating here, but I'm going to prove this. I guarantee you. I believe that that is the body's way of taking all these toxins and putting them together and then pulling them out of the body. If you read, there was a 1980s article in Life magazine called The Poisoning of America. And it was about a scientist that, I mean, it was at Shea Stadium, and she was getting up to the top of Shea Stadium and looking back down, and she said, at the ground. And she looked and she said, this is what my kid's going to inherit. And all it was PCBs and toluene and DDT in the
everywhere.
Ground.
Yeah.
And you know what the colors were? Red, green, and blue.
Jeez.
So is maybe this the way that the body is synthesizing the toxins? That's my question. But we are getting positive heavy metal loads back on these people. And you know what? We don't have to look at chemtrails. We can look at airplanes. I talk to pilots. If somebody says, well, this is a conspiracy theory and they're trying to depopulate us,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I don't believe that to be true. And I've talked to pilots. They said, yes, the normal emissions from an airplane are barium. You're going to get toluene emissions. So the other thing that's really interesting, and I'm working with a gentleman, two guys here. One guy's name is Bank, and the other is Arnell, and they own a company. It's called Anu.
Anu?
Uh-huh. Anu, Nanu, Nanu.
Yeah, really.
Anyways, they own this company called Anu. And it's just been really wonderful how God has opened up all these doors for me to meet these people. And Arnell does this incredible live blood testing. He takes a drop of blood, and then he puts it on a dark field microscope. And you can watch your blood in live time. And all of us were, playing around with it yesterday, and we were looking at, at the blood and how it looked. And, he's coming from a place where could this be something that's intrinsically something that is being made in the body? Because we all have parasites in us, don't we?
Yeah, but don't you think if it was made in the body, Tricia, they'd find that by now?
Well, I think we're finding it.
Well, let's bring you in, Amelia, for a second. She says we're finding it, are we?
There could indeed be an adaptive piece where something seems to be jump-starting this process, which
Correct.
Was seen as an oddity back in the 1600s.
Mm-hmm.
There's some natural precedent, but there seems to be an extra layer now, whether it's the introduction of a viral particle that made things more virulent, whether there's some variant of the oil
really?
And type bacteria that can take pollutants and produce something that looks like plastic or collagen.
And you know what? These people are pulling plastic. I've got samples. I talked to a doctor about a year ago, an entomologist, and these guys from Aberdeen had really strange parasitic wasps coming out of their skin. And the guy, the entomologist there, said that they had delusions of parasitosis. I'm like, yeah, right, okay.
Ooh.
But the interesting thing was, that, yes, people do remember a bite, or they remember getting hit by something. And the other thing that's really interesting to me, too, Amelia, when I did my observation, there was a young lady there from North Carolina, and I looked at her skin, and you could see there was like a film on her skin that it was tacky and gray.
Some people do have that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But then she had what looked to be like freckles, strange little freckles,
Mm-hmm.
And so we wiped these things off, and these freckles came off.
Huh.
Yeah.
Were they fibers, I wonder?
They weren't. They looked like freckles. So maybe Staniger wasn't that far off.
Yeah.
With the carbon nanotube stuff.
Hard to know.
But that's something that's in the environment. Carbon is being emitted all the time by jets.
Mm-hmm.
And so if these people are magnetic, what's hitting them?
The magnetic question is an important one, too, because I think some of my patients have interpreted it as independent movement.
Yes.
But it could be something with the static charge.
Yes.
And some people feel more itching and crawling sensations when they're around materials that they think have been exposed or around other people that they take to mean infectious.
Mm-hmm.
But it could actually be, just an activation, but not necessarily a greater risk or a worsening of the condition.
Amelia, have you ever seen people in a room together with this?
Definitely.
And everybody's itching.
I get itchier myself.
I do, too.
Fortunately.
Just watching.
I don't have this, anything insurmountable.
I know.
And in terms of the infectiousness, here you've treated so many people, you've been in so many homes, and you personally don't have it.
No.
That's a good thing.
It is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, I'm around, essential oils all the time. I'm around things that, I'm not around a lot of chemicals. But I think, my question is, what about all these nurses in the workplace
mm-hmm.
that are getting this?
So many nurses.
What are they being, environmentally, what's in that hospital? I look
And explain that, Tricia. You're saying now that medical practitioners are coming down with this?
Oh, my God. The number one most reported group of people that have this are nurses,
mm-hmm.
RNs.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez.
Number one. Number two is teachers.
Teachers?
Yeah.
As if they're getting this from kids?
I don't think so. I think, now this is just pure speculation on my part, but I'm going to prove it. In the hospital, we are around a lot of chemicals.
Yes,
all the time.
Are. Yeah.
In the school environment, look at all the pesticides in schools.
And disinfectants.
and disinfectants. Mm-hmm. Disinfectants are dangerous. They have triclosan.
And I wonder what the curriculum is for those specific teachers, what they teach. I wonder if they're science teachers,
for
example.
That's right. No, I didn't even think of that.
The Earthworm Project is huge in our elementary school.
Yeah.
And it's worth learning, but we know what earthworms are coming transported in. Soil.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep going, but, you know, I've got a guy that was a fisherman. He and his wife lived in Grand Cayman. And he was, you know, these people, if you let them tell you anything, nothing is off limits. You tell me everything, and so I can learn from you. These people are awesome.
Mm-hmm.
They will tell you, if you let them open up and say exactly what they're feeling and that nothing is off limits, you're going to find a common thread.
Tricia, how did we even get this name, Morgellons?
I have, God bless Mary Lieto, you know? I mean, I hate the name personally. But Mary Lieto, and you know, that woman has walked through fire for her children.
And by the way, is it Morgellons or Morgellons? You and I say Morgellons.
I say Morgellons. Some say Morgellons, you know, yeah. Tomatoes, tomatoes.
I did a little research in this. I spoke to a friend from France, which is where it was first described, and she said they say Morgellion.
Morgellion.
So maybe the soft G, but I
like,
I think it's a tomato,
better.
Tomato type proposition. As long as we all know we're talking about the same thing, it doesn't matter whether it's
all
a
right.
hard or a soft.
Well, so who's Mary Lieto?
Mary Lieto, it was a microbiologist, a young woman, and she noticed that her son had, he kept saying bug, bug on his lip, on his upper lip. And she worked with Randy Wymore, and at that time, you know, there just wasn't a whole lot going on, and Randy had to do work, and Mary, you know, Mary, I'm sure she got pounded by a lot of people. I know she's had a rough time of it, but God bless her. That woman fought for her children, and I don't. You know, I don't know where she's at now, but I think
she's back in Pennsylvania. She's from Pennsylvania originally, actually not that far from.
How did she come up with a name?
Well, she started to do the research when she saw those symptoms in her 2-year-old son, and she found that reference from a physician named Sir Thomas Brown in the 1600s.
Correct.
And his works are available. You can even just go to Amazon.com, Google Sir Thomas Brown. It's in A Letter to a Friend, where he's writing to a friend to console him on the death of a physician colleague. And then he starts talking about some of the interesting things he's seen through his life as a physician. And this one thing in Morgellons, France, when those ill children started to get better and these strange shapes came out of their bodies, they're drawn.
Strange hairs.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she found it.
So she tracked it all the way down to that.
Exactly.
Is this stuff fatal?
Absolutely.
But it doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have to be.
I think there's a lot of relief available, and if people can get started on identifying it, getting a medical team to help them, there's tremendous relief available. It's just like Lyme disease and its associated infections that can go on for years. If they go unaddressed and untreated, there can be all kinds of dire consequences, but there can be a huge potential for relief as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Tricia, do you believe there are parasites underneath the skin?
Yes.
Oh, God.
I think in some cases there can.
That's awful.
But not necessarily.
I'm getting midges, and everybody wants it to be one parasite. Well, guess what? It's not just one.
There's nothing simple about this.
Uh-uh. But when we were looking, working with Arnell here in California, with Anu, looking at dark field microscopy, we started looking at endobionts, and we're starting to look back at some of Pasteur's theories, where Pasteur said that all bacteria comes from the outside in, whereas, who was the other scientist? Bouchon that said, no, bacteria or generation of disease comes from the inside. out.
And mitochondria was originally a bacteria.
Correct.
That was so advantageous.
Correct.
Now it's in every cell. It's an
right,
energy source.
Right. And Bouchon, the dumb thing Bouchon did was he beat up, he said, oh, Pasteur, you're crazy, blah, blah, blah. And what happened was the medical community kind of turned on Bouchon and went with Pasteur. But guess what? They were both right.
Do people get so frustrated with this they do themselves in?
Yes.
That's the most tragic thing of all. Jeez. Is the suicides that are totally unnecessary.
I have had 3 suicides.
Because they just can't stand it?
Nobody believes them. That's the main problem.
I had a doctor give one of my patients amphotericin B, and she couldn't live with the side effects, and she hung herself.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
That's tragic.
I've had a 22-year-old nursing student take an overdose of drugs. She couldn't do it anymore.
Oh.
I mean.
And Tricia, you brought up such an interesting point, too, earlier. You were talking about supporting the immune system, whether it's holistically, whether it's through prescription
correct.
Medication, and that people got a little bit worse before they got better.
Absolutely.
That's a well-known phenomenon, even from the days of syphilis, where when there's been a long dormant or festering infection, and when it's first treated, this was called a Herxheimer reaction.
The Herxheimer, that's it.
Where there's some worsening symptoms, but then they can get better. But people need to be warned that that can happen.
Absolutely.
Because otherwise, they might think, I'm getting sicker. There's no help for me.
Absolutely.
And
Dr. Whittington, you are so right on about that. If we don't draw what lies beneath, if we don't draw that out of the body, they are never going to get better.
No, I would agree with that.
Yeah, and so that's why, you know, that's why I'm in California, basically, is working with these people. And
any studies?
We are in the process. I'm using my patent as the sacrificial lamb, and we're going to use Anu. And what we want to do is our goal is to get a grant with the National Institutes of Health, the Division of Alternative and Complementary Medicine.
Right.
And so I'm in contact with them, and we're getting ready to write a grant. And
you should get one, Tricia.
Yeah. And, you know, anybody out there that, you know, is a philanthropist, that we want to help these people. We will do anything to help these people. We want to get a study, you know. We're not out to make $1 billion off people's misery. We want to get them better.
And there may be some more traditional approaches that are very relevant, like the previous segment when the person called in and talked about how his infection, it was necrotizing fasciitis, but it had learned to outwit the antibiotics, but using essential oils. It seems very basic. It's like a body barrier.
I know. And, you know,
there's something to be said for that.
Absolutely. Amelia, I keep telling people in the hospitals, why are we still using these chemicals to clean our hands with? Those are neurotoxins. I'm a scientist, for God's sake. And that's why I don't work in the hospitals, because I don't want to be around all those chemicals. Triclosans are neurotoxins. You know, isopropyl alcohol can even be dangerous. But, and the other thing that's really interesting about this, when doctors do biopsies, skin biopsies,
yeah.
What do they put them in?
Is it formaldehyde?
Formaldehyde.
I was going to ask you about that. Tricia, thank you for being on the program. Amelia, we'll be back and take phone calls with you in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, pretty informative night. We'll be back now. We'll take your phone calls with Dr. Amelia Whittington right now on Coast to Coast AM. Amelia, the CDC investigation into Morgellons, is it going to have any teeth? Are they going to get anything accomplished here?
It's hard to know. I think it depends on how extensive the investigation will be. At this point, my understanding is that they're just looking in the state of California for a period of 2 years, working with Kaiser Permanente and its database. That may yield some good information, but it's just one section of the country, and of course it involves the health maintenance organization that may have its own interest in collecting data, which data, and what the long-term prognosis might be. So it's a start. but I would be reluctant to draw conclusions worldwide based on the findings in one state. I think it's very interesting that the NIH has independently, apparently, recognized Morgellons as a disease entity by name as of January of this year. That seems to me like an independent action and something that's very useful in terms of getting everybody talking about a similar entity.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Let's pick it up by going to our international line. Zoe in White Rock, British Columbia.
Wow.
On the international line. Hi there.
Hi, George. Can you hear me properly?
Yes, we sure can.
Good. Amelia, too. I have firsthand knowledge of this. A close friend of mine, a pharmacist, had a younger sister in the 80s who went over to Ljubljana in Slovenia, to have her leg short leg lengthened. They put that special cage on and screws through the bones and everything.
Oh,
and after it was successfully done, they took the pins out through her, you know, muscles and bones, and she had the most dreadful infection ravaging her leg.
Wow.
They went to Switzerland. They did all the intravenous antibiotics they could think of, and then her leg started going from angry red to purple and then to black. So she had the necrotizing fasciitis.
Oh, that's her heart.
Yeah, she's only about just under 18. So this was the early 80s, and they're going to take her leg off the next day. So her mom and her sister, the one I know, the pharmacist, plus her grandmother, they were in the hospital room, and the grandmother said to the specialist, please, can I try something? And they said, sure, whatever, nothing's going to work. And she rushed out, and every vacant lot in the whole of North America, here in North America too, and Europe, you can pick a plant called... There are various types of it, but plantain, essentially.
Huh.
And they picked loads of this and rubbed it in their hands and placed it on, no heat or anything, but placed it on every 10 minutes. They kept changing it on this leg all night. They stayed up all night doing this. And by 6 in the morning, when the surgeons came to prepare her for her surgery, not only had the black flesh turned back to pink, but the blood poisoning lines up her leg had gone back a number of inches.
That quickly?
Remarkable.
Yeah. They started to, they said, well, you know, we'll give you another day. And by the time they'd plastered her with this stuff, they didn't use heat or anything, just plainly plastered her leg with it. She left the hospital in 3 days, perfectly healthy, flew back to Canada, and is now still alive today. I mean, I know these people very well. And the old grandmother said the old people, when they were fighting in wars hundreds of years in Europe, they all knew this, and they would stop, you know, gangrene this way. So I just thought, for your research and for people listening, when you get a cut, any kind of little nick, I know it's worked on me when I've had a whittler or something terrible going under my nail. I had a terrible splinter go right under my nail and start a horrible infection. I simply put these leaves on top of my nail.
Wow.
And within 4 hours, I had got rid of the pus had come out. Everything was gone. So there's something in plantain that does it, and it doesn't grow in the winter, so you can buy a tincture of it in a health food store.
Just plantain.
Plantain, P-L-A-N-T-A-I-N.
Excellent.
Yes.
Good to know.
Good
and
to
who
know.
Knows if maybe
Take
that's
care.
Some kind of...
Wonderful. And God bless you with your work.
Oh, well, thank you. And Dr. Wymore asked me to remind people they can register at his research site, morgellons.okstate.edu.
Okay. And what does that do when you register?
That would be if someone thinks they might be affected or a family member, they can register and leave their contact information for further research.
Okay, very good. Let's go to our first-time caller in Bellingham, Washington. Hello, Sandy. Go ahead.
Good evening, folks.
Hi.
This is a very informative evening, and I have some vital information I think you might appreciate. I have had Morgellons disease for about 4 years, and I've been studying it every day trying to figure out what's going on. And I've got it pretty much under control.
Great.
And I've done it through... taking hot, really hot Epsom salts baths, number one. taking drinking vinegar with hot water. This stuff doesn't like heat, and it doesn't like acidic things.
Interesting.
You can take, for skin lesions and stuff, you can take clear, what do you call it, for a packaging tape, like for postal packaging tape, the clear stuff, really sticky. But if you use the clear stuff, then you can hold it up to the light and see what you get. And you stick that on your inflected area and hold it there for a while and rub it and get it nice and hot and then just rip it off. And you'd be surprised what comes off with it. Another way is cayenne pepper.
Cayenne will do it.
And what it does is it raises your blood temperature. And this stuff doesn't like heat. And what I have found is there's certain foods I can't eat because it just enhances it. And I sincerely believe this stuff is it falls out of the sky. I've seen it outside. That's why birds get it. Animals that live outside, they get it. Their fur coats protect them pretty much, but it comes in through their eyes. I get it through my eyes. And it's just under the skin. It's just like in your, the lymph area.
Yeah.
The lymph doesn't have a pump in your system. It has to push around by your muscle movement. And so this stuff will accumulate in certain areas. And you can actually push it around if you really work at it. And there's one other way you can combat it, and that is to take vinegar and pour it on your arm, and let it sit for a little bit, and then rub it in, and take a rather sharp scraper and hold it flat on your arm, push down and slide it, and you can spot this stuff right out of your system.
All right, Amelia, old remedies. Have you heard of any of these? Thank you, by the way,
Absolutely.
For the call.
And again, what's great about this is it's holistic, it's affordable, and it can give relief. I've had patients tell me individually different of those approaches, different combinations. And this is definitely holding true from what I'm hearing across the country with people achieving some relief from these very basic types of remedies.
Well, maybe after this program, Amelia, you'll start getting some mainstream media jumping on board because that's what this also needs to. We need a major push to get the CDC really rolling into this area. Like Trish was saying, I would love for her to get some grant money for this organization that you all participate in so somebody can start doing some real science into this.
Exactly. And people can be sharing affordable remedies with each other. I mean, I think the last two callers have made excellent points. Some of these things are lost to, the current push to have name brand medications and expensive solutions. Really, the whole point is to support the immune system, and people in the Morgellons community are very active with self-help, and these kinds of things are just so valuable to share.
Next up, let's go to Loretta, west of the Rockies. She's in Lakewood, Colorado. Hi, Loretta. Good morning.
I have a relative who was just telling me last week of these symptoms that she has, and in the research she's done, she is seeing Magellans. She's a student, doesn't have insurance, and you mentioned getting a medical team to help. How would you go about getting this medical team?
If she's eligible for any kind of coverage, even disability, I think first finding somebody who's knowledgeable in terms of recognizing that a person can have chronic infections, that Morgellons exist. And then the NMO website has some wonderful resources in California, Ginger Stavely and Dr. Raphael Stricker, and newly Dr. Ginger Stavely, are treating people with frequently generic medications, combinations of things, some that are more naturopathic, some that do involve prescription, but some older and more affordable prescription, and it really needs to be individualized for each person in terms of what they've been exposed to, what co-infections they might have, and having someone who's experienced enough clinically to diagnose if there might be Lyme disease or another co-infection. These tests can be unreliable. They can be expensive, too.
Mm-hmm.
And with enough clinical experience, a person can get a pretty good sense of what they're dealing with and start to treat without having to wait for a long series of tests that might not be conclusive.
But how do you find these people that are knowledgeable about this condition?
There are some websites where a person can seek out Lyme-literate physicians. And I say that's probably the first step, because at least those are people who are aware that there can be coexisting infections, lingering infections. There are disagreements within the medical community about what characterizes Lyme. But the bottom line is it's a spirochete, a little bit like syphilis, and we all know how complicated syphilis was. This is even more so. So starting there and then saying there's this information on Margellan, here's a link to a website. Everybody in that community will know Dr. Stricker's name and probably Ginger Savely's name, and here's what they're seeing, and there's a lot of information sharing in that community. So I think just the awareness from square one, and there are plenty of family doctors and public health-oriented doctors who have been working with my patients for years, not even knowing that Margellans existed, but responding to what the patients are telling them and coming up with very similar treatment plans to this team in California.
Is there a Nobel Prize here for anybody who comes up with a cure?
I think it would be fantastic, or at least substantial relief. And I think the communities where there are, you know, chronic infections, lingering infections, are recognizing each other. For example, there's a big benefit for Lyme disease next weekend in Connecticut. They're honoring the Nobel Prize winner from France for HIV because some of the principles are similar in terms of how to handle a chronic infection, treat it so that the level of infection is brought down enough so that the person's own immune system can start to kick in and help them keep it under control.
Are any pharmaceutical companies working on any of this quietly?
I'm not sure. It's a mixed bag because, for example, in the pre-recognition of fibromyalgia era, it was considered not to be real, quote-unquote. Now there are a couple of expensive prescription medications, and it's very real, and there's a lot of advertising behind it. Fibromyalgia was always a real entity. We're still figuring out what's causing it. I have a colleague who had ulcers 40 years ago. She was seen as a malingerer. This was a stress-related disease. Finally, they figure out a bacteria causes it, Helicobacter pylori, and there's a treatment. So I'm hoping that we can get a breakthrough like that, but it's very real. And we don't just have to have expensive medications to combat it. And antibiotic resistance is here. I'd love to see companies put themselves behind finding better antibiotics. That's an expensive long-term proposition, I'm sure.
Let's go to our next wildcard line in Spring, Texas. Jerry, good morning.
Good morning there, George. I didn't catch the lady's name.
Amelia, Dr. Amelia.
Amelia.
Hello.
Good evening there, George and Amelia. I have a question for you there. You may think I'm crazy for asking. I lost my mother with colon cancer, and then after they took out 24 inches of it there, or a foot of it there, well, she was clear for about 3 years, and then her eyes started failing, and she went in and they said, well, you got cataracts, Ms. Nolan. We need to take your blood test. She says, well, I just got through going and having all my tests made, and I'm perfectly clear. Well, we'll just do it again. Well, came up, and they did a scan on her, and she had three spots on her liver the size of a silver dollar. She had liver cancer.
I'm so sorry.
Okay. The lady, one of the hostage people, came over and talked to us about what was going to happen to her.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to turn yellow within about 3 to 4 weeks, and she's going to start itching real terribly bad to where nothing will phase it.
Mm-hmm.
Liver cleans all the impurities out of you. But has anybody done a test on these people's liver to see just what's going on their liver and kidneys?
In Morgellons disease.
Right.
Anybody done any test on that? Because your liver's got something to do with keeping you from itching from all this stuff that's floating around your blood that you're not supposed to have. It cleans your blood.
That's a very good point. It clears the toxins. And when she started to get metastases there, it disrupted the liver's ability to do that. And then when some of the toxins were building up, you know, when the bilirubin, the blood cell byproducts, can't be broken down, that can lead to the jaundice and itching very badly. But it's still a similar principle with any chronic infection where there are problems clearing toxins from the system.
Amelia, how long would a blind study take to put together and conduct?
That's a very good question. A
couple years at least?
I would think so, because it's such a complex situation, and there may be existing co-infections and so forth. But I will say, in answer to the gentleman's question, usually liver and kidney functions are followed pretty closely, especially if medications are being prescribed, to make sure that they're not having a toxic effect. But the good news about Morgellons is people have sometimes asked, does it build up within organs? People are afraid, do cysts form? Is it that kind of a situation? It doesn't appear to be thus far. This appears to be a skin-related manifestation or you know, dermis that even goes internally, but it doesn't seem to root deeply in liver or other organs.
Have you ever been to Tampa, Florida?
I sure have.
Well, you're going there right now again with Carrie, east of the Rockies. Hey, Carrie, go ahead.
Yes, hello, Dr. Amelia and Trish. How are you doing? I'm a Morgellon sufferer. I'm better. I'm 80% better using alternative medications. But my question to you is this. I have observed in my neighborhood an extreme amount of funguses on citrus trees.
Oh.
Fusarium on the trunk, sooty mold on the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
An increasing amount of lichen on the trunk, and I've lived in my neighborhood for 27 years. I have never seen the amount of fungus on citrus trees and ornamentals like I have seen now. Anyways, recently, long ago, about 3 months or 4 months ago, my husband was picking some oranges on my neighbor's overhanging limbs on my backyard, and I was cleaning some oranges, and there was leaves and sooty mold, and I found some insect. It looked to me like insect filled with funguses. It started burrowing inside my hand, okay?
Burrowing
inside my hand from the citrus tree.
Wow.
And now, since then, I've developed Morgellons.
Wow.
So now I'm figuring out and done some research myself. What is causing this mutation of funguses? What is this insect seem to be filled with them in their own system? They are carrying no longer the funguses, but agents and possibly co-infections with bacteria.
Could be.
Yes. And I have figured out through some research I've done with scientists from the Saskatoon, Canada, Agriculture Department, they have found out that the use of glyphosate chemical in Monsanto Roundup and insecticides that are being sprayed on cotton to defoliate the leaves, so it will be easy to pick the cotton. They are being sprayed on corn. They are being sprayed on our food on wheat and also in people's backyards.
I think we will quickly find that chemicals have a lot to do with this, Amelia. Let's come right back, and we'll take final phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Dwayne Elgin joins us, The Living Universe. Think about that title for a moment. We'll come right back, though, and take final phone calls on Morgellons on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Amelia, what are you working on personally with all of this these days?
I think really just trying to put together individual plans for each of my patients, because each does have distinct concerns, but also trying to get a sense if there are variations throughout the country, you know, really trying to network with other people who are treating this and seeing this, and just generally trying to raise awareness. I see it as a real gap in my education that I had never even heard of this until last October, and I'd been seeing it for years. So just getting the word out. So
now, generally, what are the programs you put together for your people or your patients?
It's usually a combination of treatments. First, trying to figure out if there is an underlying immunocompromising condition that hasn't been addressed yet. Some people already have been diagnosed with Lyme disease. There are also some chronic infections frequently seen in this area, Babesia, Bartonella, very common insect-borne illnesses. So trying to get some of those under control, because each of those can interfere with one another and block the immune response. But also looking at diet. Is the person getting adequate rest? Some of my patients report that eating processed sugars tend to exacerbate their symptoms, and having a more Natural diet, fewer additives, fewer processed foods seems to be helpful. It's really putting together from all different areas what people are finding gives relief.
Okay, let's go to the phones again. Here we go. Let's go to Winnipeg in Canada. Valerie, you're up with us. Hi, Val.
Oh, hello. Hey. Bear with me. I'm a bit nervous. My first time calling.
Well, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, this is great. I am a Morgellon sufferer. And before I ask my question or questions, a little bit of background. I find it kind of ironic from what came up tonight is I actually traveled a bit in the U.S. and I noticed the symptoms after a trip to Mississippi, Louisiana, the Gulf Coast.
Ah.
And I just kind of always thought there was a bit of a link. And I do remember being bitten in the neck by what I suspected was a spider.
Oh, yeah.
Outside. So I just think there's a link there. Also, I had a... I don't know if there's a link with the military, but my ex just happened to be an American up here on exchange, and he, you know, he kind of had weird symptoms too, and then, I don't know. I just think there is some connection with something that's either in the air or, you know, is in our, maybe in a vaccine or something.
Absolutely.
But my problem is, you know, again, I could go on forever, but I know there's other callers. I'm in Winnipeg, Canada, and I have tried everything with the medical community. I'm not going to waste any more time. I've exhausted that. But there's no support. There's no network here. Absolutely no one believes me. You cannot understand the nightmare. This has turned my life upside down. I've lost everything you can imagine, like career, friends. You know, I've been disfigured because I've had so many lesions. And, like, that's the way I view it is because of scars and it's overwhelmed me. And I don't know where, I don't want to get all emotional, but I don't know what to do anymore. And
well, that's what we're doing this show here for.
Oh, the diagnosis that the doctors have given me, unbelievable. So if you know if there's anybody I can contact even in the neighborhood or something that, or what can I do to maybe get the doctors to open their minds a bit?
One thing that I think could be helpful is I believe that the Lyme disease website may cover North America, or at least if there's someone right over the border who might be able to at least advise or somehow help, just give some perspective saying, absolutely, this exists, to collaborate. The Internet network is so good. So I'll give you a couple of websites that I think it's worth at least looking for references. I'm not sure if the Lyme disease one pertains to Canada as well, but I know Canada has a very good Lyme website as well. And the only reason I keep coming back to that is so many people with Morgellons ultimately end up being diagnosed with Lyme. And at least that community is more organized at this point to post lists. You can put in your zip code or your location and say a certain mile radius and at least find somebody knowledgeable. And then sometimes there will be support groups with that or people that you can connect with. And you probably know there are two famous Canadians who have gone public with having Morgellons. One is Joni Mitchell. The other is Cliff Mickelson. And Cliff is online. There are recordings of radio interviews he's given. He's fantastic. So at least to hear somebody who's lived with this for 9 years and is improving and able to make some headway is just so inspiring. So if you have a pen, in terms of trying to find a physician somewhere in your neck of the woods, go to www.lympa.org.
Better spell that out, Amelia.
Yeah, it would be www and then lympa.org. And that's the Lyme Disease Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania, which is run by Doug Ferson. And he has a wonderful network of links on that site. You can then register to find, it's called a Lyme Literate Medical Doctor, LLMD. And you should be able to look throughout the nation and possibly North America for somebody who's registered to say they're knowledgeable about treating chronic infections and co-infections and can maybe help you make some headway.
Is this the same Lyme disease, by the way, that you get from ticks?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and there's increasing awareness that sometimes when it's caught very early on and treated right away, it can resolve completely. God bless those people where that happens the way it's supposed to happen. It's wonderful. However, if it goes undetected, it can end up, you know, going into connective tissue, into nervous tissue, forming cysts, being difficult to treat, and then we can look at something that lingers for a long time and can be working destructively behind the scenes to really weaken the immune system. And in the U.S. and Canada, you know, there's been battles back and forth between the societies, but increasingly it's just very clear some people are very affected by this.
Okay, let's go to Rockford, Illinois. First-time caller is Kate. Kate, thanks for calling. You're on.
Oh, thank you. I'm just wondering if anyone has taken a look at aluminum, because it's so prolific in soaps, deodorants, lotions, all the things we put on our skin. And I know I was having severe problems, and someone told me to try eliminating it, and it was just amazing at how many things I was using that had it. And it cleared up. It took a year and a half to get rid of some of these lesions, but it did work. And I'm wondering if anyone is looking at that in relation to Morgellons.
I think so. And I think people might have sensitivities to
That's part of the heavy metals, isn't it?
Common. Yeah.
Possibly, or even solvents. And, you know, different people may have differing sensitivities, but if there does seem to be something that's irritating,
Even cooking in it, my gosh. You know, my food was being cooked in something that was bothering my skin.
Exactly.
And I just thought, gosh, if nothing else, it's one more thing to try.
Exactly. And it's something, again, very proactive, and you can work on, you know, selectively taking out the things that you think might be affecting. And that's why the individualization of the treatment, too, is really important.
Okay. What is insurance about this? Anything?
Oh, boy. At this point, insurance is tough because even when something is recognized, often they'll want to go with the most conservative guideline in terms of what they'll cover.
Reject, 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 right?
Sometimes. On the other hand, and even with disability applications, if a person concentrates on the symptoms and what's being done to relieve the symptoms, it gives a much better sense of how the person is impaired or struggling and how it's being targeted, usually the coverage is better. I mean, sometimes, you know, saying Lyme disease or Morgellons could put up a red flag. You know, well, here's this controversial thing. You know, how can they possibly follow a guideline? Well, the thing is, it needs to be so individualized that sometimes if you just really characterize the symptoms, then, you know, like, oh, okay, we're treating 10 concerns with this person. You know, and each thing that's being treated is being treated with something reasonable. Sometimes you're better off just being very specific.
Let's go to Knoxville, Tennessee, east of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hello there.
Good evening.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wanting to ask a couple of questions.
Sure.
What about anemia? Has there been anemia associated?
Definitely. And I think sometimes with chronic infections that can deplete. You know, sometimes the red cell count, sometimes there'll be low white cells. Other times, if there's lingering co-infection, there might be an increase in monocytes, eosinophils. So looking at that complete blood count is really important, and there might be some clues there.
When I first heard about Morgellons, 3 years ago, a friend of a chiropractor across the country, a friend, called me up and told me about it. I recognized it immediately as a lungworm infection. Very unusual. Well, it's not unusual. It's hard to see, hard to recognize. George, I sent you an email with some links on it.
Okay.
And it looks like ringworm?
Tongue worm. Pentastomid?
Oh, a pinworm? Yes.
Pentastomid. It's something that most parasitologists are not very familiar with, even. Everything fits. It accounts for the fibers.
Yeah.
The fiber matrix that grows between the cuticles, and it's part of their immune response system, and it accounts for most everything.
It could certainly be a factor, and yet we also heard Dr. Weimer describing that when they look under the microscope and try to characterize it as something that's known, we're seeing something different, but then again, it could be generated by some of these more common common. I mean, there's a common report of parasitic involvement, often at some point in the process, even if in the beginning. And since we know that infections can be carried by parasites, you know, insects, possibly worms, possibly fungus, that could be a starting point for some of this.
Okay, let's go to Michelle in Atlanta, Georgia. You're up with us.
Yes, hi.
Hi,
thank you very much. I've been suffering with this for a very long time, and I have this question. Does Morgellons cycle, where you have severe itching at times, and then you'll have days where it's not, you know, very noticeable, because that's what's happening with me, and there are no lesions and there are no fibers, but there's every other symptom with extreme itching, crawling, biting sensations, not to mention all the other, you know, problems with eye floaters and brain fog, which are very secondary. The only thing that really is a problem in my world is the fact that the itching is so extreme. And I've tried everything from permethrin to, you know, tea tree oil to everything you can imagine, and nothing has broken it down and nothing has helped.
That's very familiar. I do think there's a cycle to it, and I think that sometimes there can even be seasonal cycles, and sometimes it does hark back, I think, maybe even to, you know, a vegetative component to it. I don't know yet if you've had a chance to try anything that might treat from an antimicrobial perspective, but myself and some of my patients have gotten some relief from that terrible itching, sometimes with a combination of low-dose antihelminthic, something like ivermectin. You know, and again, I try to start with inexpensive and generic just because that's a good place to start.
Ivermectin, we used to use that to worm racehorses.
Exactly. The veterinarians are very familiar with it. And sometimes for, say, a very severe case of scabies, they'll recommend, you know, a big dose and then another one a week later. This is a little bit different approach, and Dr. Savely and Dr. Stricker have had some good results with it, where a small amount is taken on a daily basis. And at first there may be questions from the insurance company or the pharmacy, but explaining that this is a persistent type of infection and that this is necessary to try to achieve perhaps a bacteriostasis, to wrestle it down enough so that your immune system can kick in. But before I ever had the skin manifestations, I could be up all night itching. You know, it was awful. And I thought maybe it's a medication I'm taking or something in my environment. I tried to eliminate things selectively. It was really horrendous. But there is relief possible. Probably needs to be individualized for you. But, you know, there may be even a coexisting infection or something aggravating that. But chances are, you know, a combination of a couple of possibly antimicrobial, antiparasitic, even at a relatively low dose, might help.
So, all right, let's go to Phil in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Phil.
Hello there, George. Good program. Very important.
Yes.
This is a multiple complex issue. I've been reading about it over the years, and we've noticed chemtrails here in Michigan on and off sporadically. My thought is, first off, you've got a very well-known problem with amongst everybody, a common denominator, so to speak, parasites. So I would be attacking that with even with the herbal remedies now that they have. I can't think of them right off the top of my head, walnut extract, and there's a bunch of them. But I would go that way. Now, also, the possibility of light therapy, and I'm just an idea to throw on the table,
mm-hmm.
Perhaps we dial up the light therapy to see how it affects on certain people, and does it kill the parasites that are in the lesions, and you know, without, you know, harmful radiation, but you know, you have different waves of light that can do all sorts of wonderful things now that people are experimenting with, and you know, that's what I would do if I had this situation, and you know, God bless all you folks out there that are battling this. Hopefully you'll find a remedy with so many people, you know, with the internet and everything, and with possibilities, hopefully, that will be coming forth.
And you bring up a good point, you know, to really look into what's out there. There are some people who report relief from certain types of electromagnetic stimulation, Rife machine, that kind of thing. There are a number of different things that can help support the immune system, help support a person's ability to battle these. And people may have different elements involved, and some will respond to light therapy. Some might respond to antibiotics, tea tree oil, oregano oil, the Epsom salt. You know, I've heard, you know, people reporting responses to all of the above in combination, too.
What's the saddest case you've ever seen? I've got a minute left.
Suicides.
Yeah.
You know, where the person just felt like there was no hope and nobody believed them, and that's why your program is so important, just to get people talking, to realize this exists. If they don't have it, they might know someone who does, and just to say there are resources to get some perspective on this.
Well, we believe them, Amelia. Don't we?
Thank you.
That's the important
thing. Me too.
We believe, and we want them to know they've got a voice out here in the darkness.
I really appreciate it. You've done some good programs on it.
Get the website out for us again.
www.vnmo, and so THENMO, all lowercase, no spaces, .org. And there are excellent links there to all kinds of resources.
Great. Thanks, Amelia. I appreciate you being on the program. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.